the book is always better line. Film isn't book and shouldn't be judged that way. When book is translated into film, that is an act of adaptation.
Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, and it's a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm Louis O'Flaherty, your host and the producer of the show. On this episode, I interview two experts and have them compare the 2005 movie release of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with the book that was published back in 1950. So if you do the math, at the time I'm releasing this, it's the 15th anniversary of that movie and 70th for the book. My guests are Dr. Crystal Downing, co-director of the Marion E. Waite Center at Wheaton College, and Dr. Charlie Starr, who teaches at AB University in Philippi, West Virginia. Both have authored several books that I link to in the show notes. Speaking of notes, please note that this is the first of a two-part show. That's because we recorded usable material for well over an hour, even with my typical let the guests talk by basically just pitching the questions I created. One final thing to realize is, unfortunately, at times the audio level drops out briefly for each of my guests, and I decided to not have them repeat what they said because it would have interrupted the flow of what they were sharing. With that said, let's join the audio where I greet my guest. Thanks for agreeing to be on the show today.
I am happy to be here, William. It's amazing to think that it's been 15 years since The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe came out as a film.
I am delighted as well.
While each of you could talk later in greater detail about your experience and love of film, let's get on the table an overview of what you do and don't expect when you see any movie adaptation of a book.
Things that I do expect from a film adaptation, the main elements of the plot to be present, a complete story arc for the main characters, both in terms of plot and character development. What I don't expect from a film adaptation of a book is that all the subplots will be present. Not all of the minor characters going to be there. And especially, I don't expect there to be lots of psychological exploration, which often takes place by the narrator, by the speaking of a narrator. And in film, though you can have narrators, they just don't talk as much as a narrator in a book might, and that's appropriate for film. That's how film operates. So I really did miss Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings films, but going in to see the first film, I knew he wasn't going to be there. Things had to be cut out. That's how adaptation from book to film works. And so I wasn't disappointed because I knew that was going to happen.
Yes, Charlie, you summarized superbly what film theorists recognize about adaptation. There is a famous statement by a French filmmaker where he says, and I love this line, an honest adaptation is a betrayal. And you can interpret that on two different levels. So an honest adaptation, in other words, if you tried to film every single moment in a novel and put it on a screen, it would be a horrible movie. You have to eliminate subplots. But also, the other interpretation of his statement, an honest adaptation is a betrayal, to make it honestly reflect the original source text, you have to betray various elements in the text. And part of this is because film is a visual medium versus novel. Obviously, we're just reading words on a page. So an essential element of a film adaptation is trying to figure out how do you externalize the internal. And when you have long passages of what's going through a person's mind, you could do voiceover, as Charlie alluded to, but classical Hollywood cinema considers that kind of cheating. It's just too easy to do. So how can you instead communicate what a person is thinking by visual actions? And one of the really cliched ways a lot of films do this now is by showing people vomiting on screen. I mean, so they literally externalize the internal, because how do we show this person is really upset by what they're seeing? Oh, they go over and vomit against the side of the building. Well, how many times have we ever seen people vomit just out of distress, other than gastric stress? And yet I see it all the time in film and television. So that's another way that filmmakers cheat.
Well, now, thinking back to your younger days, you know, 15 years ago, tell us what your gut reaction was when you first saw the Hollywood production of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I just would like to say it captured me from the opening music, and this film has quite deservedly been nominated for awards for the music. So that tense music, and then seeing the airplanes coming over London for the Battle of Britain, it builds tension. But that's a good example of providing, adding things to a film that actually give it substance to reinforce what the context of the film is. Because, of course, Lewis was writing about something that he went through, the Battle of Britain. This is the reason children were evacuated. And I think if we're going to show this film to contemporary children, they need to understand, why are all these parents putting their children on trains? How could they do that? So I was armed right from the beginning.
Somewhere in a parallel universe, there is a Charlie Starr who went into film studies instead of literary studies. I have a little bit of a film background. I did do some film study, and I have taught film, but I am mostly an English teacher. But I'm the English teacher who always found himself having to justify film to his English teacher friends, mm-hmm. who would always criticize film with the famous, "the book is always better" line.
Mm-hmm.
But film isn't book and shouldn't be judged that way. When book is translated into film, that is an act of adaptation. I suppose it would be worth spending some time thinking about how Lewis's concept of transposition can be applied to the adaptation of any book story to film. So that's an interesting concept, maybe for another conversation. But if the question is, was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe a faithful adaptation of the book? For me, it was. I loved the film, and I still think it's a strong film.
Let's dig a little deeper then into some specifics. Let's first consider, what did you especially enjoy about the 2005 movie? Or in other words, what did they get right?
Well, I loved Aslan, who was a computer-generated figure and cutting-edge and state-of-the-art in terms of the technology. And I think Aslan may have been the thing that Douglas Gresham loved the most, because C.S. Lewis expressed his concern that if the book were ever made into a movie, Aslan had to be done so incredibly well that to do otherwise would be almost blasphemous. And as I understand it, the rendering time for a single second of Aslan on screen was somewhere around a month. And by rendering time, we mean you create the digital Aslan lion character, and then you tell the computer, now make it go into motion, make it happen. And it took huge computer banks a month to actually render that single second of Aslan for screen time. So I thought they just did a brilliant job. I totally believed in the lion as a real lion. I loved the White Witch. I loved the costume. I loved the casting choice. I love her little petty moment where she kills the butterfly.
Yes.
Yeah, great. I thought the casting for Lucy was perfect. I love Mr. Beaver and Tumnus. I love the epic battle sequence. I loved the dead blue bottle, the dead housefly, how they cut to that briefly. And the reason I love that is because Lewis mentions it in the book, but it is also a callback to a series of poems that Lewis wrote about a bee that is banging itself into a window and trying to get out into the beautiful, open, spacious air. And he can't get himself into that heaven that he longs for until in the poem, the owner of the house carefully picks it up in a handkerchief and takes it outside to release it. So the blue bottle is something like that child, Lucy, wanting to get out of the world that she's found herself stuck in. And suddenly the door opens up. Suddenly the window is raised and Lucy can escape into a land of wonder. So I like the fact that the film actually gave homage to that little moment and only just, you know, a second or two of film time. A couple more things I'll say. I like the fact that the Turkish delight box and the cup that Edmund is drinking from both turn to snow as soon as they're tossed aside, indicating the false nature of the magic that has filled his stomach. And I loved how they gave the lamppost roots at its base so that it looked like it grew up out of the ground. Again, a nice connection to the magician's nephew. Finally, I thought Aslan's death was done really well.
I would agree with all that Charlie said. In fact, Dorothy Sayers was put off by Pauline Baines' illustrations of Aslan. She thought Baines made Aslan seem too much like a teddy bear-esque rather than, the sense of course, he's not safe, but he's good. And I felt the image of Aslan captured that. There were a lot of interesting insertions in the film that elevated it beyond just a generic children's film. For example, I loved how when the family at the start of the film, the Pevensies, are running to the bomb shelter, Edmund goes back yelling, "Father!" And so we think, oh, the father is still in the house. And he runs and grabs a photograph of his father where the glass has been shattered into shards and then takes it out to the bomb shelter, a shelter. Well, that connects then with an element in Lewis's text where after Tumnus's cave house has been ravaged by the White Queen's minions, a picture of his father has been slashed and is lying on the floor. And so what the filmmakers did is they show Edmund, when he enters Tumnus's house, stepping on that image of the father. So what that does, and this is a sign of good filmmaking, it creates a visual connection between Tumnus and Edmund. And then the film sustains that connection by putting them, and this is another added scene, but it's externalizing the internal insofar as Tumnus and Edmund have both betrayed the rest of the Pevensey children. So that provides a type of externalizing of Edmund's motivation since we can't get inside his brain.
That was a wonderful connection. I've never seen that connection before. I love being able to get together with fellow Lewis lovers and learn new things from each other.
Well, let's look at maybe somewhat of a negative per se. What do you feel they could and should have done better in the film?
Well, I thought the battle scene went on too long, and it's especially ironic since Lewis explicitly states in his text that the battle was over in minutes, Nevertheless, I understand why they wanted the battle scene to go on. This you could interpret as externalizing the internal, especially when they give us a close-up on Edmund's face, as though to say this battle is an externalization of the battle that has been going on in Edmund's heart throughout the text. But I just think they could have cut it down a bit.
In that regard, I suppose I might defend the battle sequence as almost an economic need.
Yes.
If you're going to spend, you know, a couple $100 million on a film, you're going to have spectacle. And the only way you're going to produce a film that has so many special effects and that ends up being so expensive then is to make a film that is going to include eye candy. And I think it's fair to say that it is eye candy. It's way cool. But Lewis probably would not have been happy with it. But I can see why they would have had to do it for the economic side of things. In the same way that many of the battles that take place in the Lord of the Rings films are much longer than any time that Tolkien gave to them.
Right.
But they were kind of necessary so that we could get to the third film, right? So that the production company would continue to pay for it. Things I would have liked to have seen done better. I thought Edmund was the weakest casting choice. I thought he got better as an actor in the next couple of movies, but he was the weakest casting choice, I thought. I would have loved to have kept Aslan's romp with Susan and Lucy after his resurrection. I can see why they needed to cut it, but I wish that had been there. Of all the reviews of the film that I read, I thought the one that stood out as the fairest critique, the fairest negative of the film, was one written by Lewis Marcos, who said that the biggest flaw in the film, in his mind, was that it becomes centered on the choices that the children make. Are we going to stay or are we going to leave? Rather than on the choice that Aslan makes. And the focus becomes centered too much on the kids and not enough on Aslan, even though you do have that long, beautiful, terrible scene of his sacrificial death. In Marcos's idea, though, it becomes very much about the kids and their choice, and they become the center of the action. And maybe that wasn't what Lewis would have wanted.
How I would respond to that, and I think you are exactly right. And this goes back to your comment about marketing. This is the trouble. One of the main differences between a film adaptation versus an original novel. A novel doesn't cost that much to produce, where a film is just has to think about the how much money it's going to earn. Now, what I saw them doing in order to create visual stimulation, and this is a big part, is how do we keep stimulating the audiences so they don't get bored with what we're doing? And they changed the character of the fox so that we, rather than the fox just having this tea party that's turned into stone by the white witch, they have the fox sacrificing himself to avoid revealing where the children are. And we see him caught up in the wolf's jaws so that we watch Edmund watching the fox. And this is another externalizing of the internal. So he sees the fox who is sacrificing himself to save others. And it is after that moment where Edmund feels some type of compassion. And I agree with you, Charlie, Edmund was not a strong actor, but he feels some kind of compassion. And that's when he turns to the witch and explains everything he knows. But he was doing it inspired by saving the life of the fox. So they displaced, they spread out the idea that the highest good is sacrificed for the other by displacing it on.
Well, now, were there any forgivable mistakes or changes? I know, Charlie, you already addressed that in terms of coming off of what Crystal said, but what additionally might you say about either something else or further about what you've already said?
One potential mistake that I'm not 100% sure is a mistake is the idea of Lucy entering a winter wonderland. To first enter Narnia in winter, on the one hand, ought to inspire wonder. On the other hand, this is a dangerous winter. And I wonder if, in terms of set design, it might have been better to make the place look ominous rather than wonderful. I think Michael Ward has mentioned that he would have preferred that approach. I'm not so sure myself, but I understand the point that Narnia in winter is beautiful, but perhaps it shouldn't be. Nevertheless, to see the look on little Georgie's face was fantastic, and maybe it's forgivable for that reason alone. There's a scene that's completely added that involves the crossing of the river as the ice is breaking up, and then the children float down the river, and Peter has jammed his sword into a piece of floating ice. I thought that was a great deal of fun, necessary there for the spectacle. Didn't bother me that it's a complete addition to the story. So I think it's forgivable.
I would agree with Charlie about that ice flow scene. Once again, create the to externalize the internal. All Lewis gives us is the subtle little changes of flowers and green grass growing. But this is a dramatic change. We are seeing the results of the melting away of the White Witch's kingdom. And also that it reinforces the statement, of course, Aslan isn't safe, but he's good. I mean, that scene is not a safe scene, but it is part of Aslan's goodness that the ice is melting away. As far as changes that I would celebrate were the tiny little insertions of humor into the film. There's so much tension, like the ice flow scene, like the battle scene, to give us those lyrical moments. And this goes back to what Charlie was talking about in terms of missing Tom Bombadil in Lord of the Rings. Bombadil added a certain lyricism, and we just feel so admired in darkness for much of Lord of the Rings. But anyway, so some of my favorite humorous moments were when Edmund is on a horse and goes, he says, get up, horsey, horsey. And the horse turns and goes, my name is Philip. And it was just a sweet moment. And what is very annoying in films that have children is when the filmmakers try to make them humorous by giving children grown-up lines. And I think that is a flaw for many filmmakers. But this film did not do that. It maintained the childlikeness of the children at their various ages. Also, when the White Witch asks Edmund, I will give you whatever you want. And he says, can you make me taller? And that was a sweet little moment. And then they built on the moment when Lewis describes Edmund in the courtyard with all the frozen figures. And remember, he draws glasses on a lion and a mustache. Then later, after the whole Narnia has been cleared of the ice, that Aslan has come to reign, we see animals surrounding the children, but there is a lion, and it's only in a shot for maybe 10 seconds, but a lion that still has the drawing of the glasses around his eyes and the mustache.
I remember that.
And so that was a very humorous element. Even when Susan, several times, they ask her, well, you're from Spare Room. And she goes, I'm from Finchley, or we're from Finchley. Evidently, one of the people who worked on the film was from Finchley.
Nice connection to Lewis's poem, Finchley Avenue, with that, too.
Oh, perfect. Let me just comment on this ominous element. I think the filmmakers did a good job. We need to understand why Lucy just doesn't run back into the wardrobe. So I would disagree with Michael Ward there. I think if you're going to externalize the internal, we need an explanation of what keeps Lucy in Narnia. So she has the enchantment first, and then what the filmmakers do is add the ominous element after Tumnus takes her to his cave. And I don't know if you remember, but after Lucy enters the cave, we see Tumnus behind her looking both ways to make sure nobody sees them going into the cave. And then they go inside, he locks the door, we see him hide the key. And that is very ominous. We go, what is this this fun planning to do with this young girl? So it's consonant with what Lewis is talking about, because of course he wants to give her up, and he confesses to her he's going to give her up to the White Witch. But the viewer doesn't necessarily know that, but they feel, oh, all is not safe in this realm. So I think it's the best of both worlds.
I think that really helps me understand and see the justification for that better, because it fits perfectly with the way the witch actually tempts Edmund too. Let's tempt him with the beauty and the wonder and the tasty treats.
Right.
Before we see the ominousness. So I bow to your wisdom on that one. I think that's wonderful. Good point. You know, speaking of Edmund saying, can you make me taller? As I understand it, the actor grew 2 inches shooting of the video of the film. So they had to keep remaking his costumes, and they were very much afraid that his voice would crack before they were done shooting, and that his voice would lower. So they really had to hurry it along to make sure that that didn't happen.
Well, something I read, and I just surveyed what Wikipedia had, so who knows how accurate this is, but that Edmund's voice actually did break during the filming. And so they hired his sister to do dubbing of his voice for the later scenes.
Oh, wow. That's great. I was just going to add then also that my favorite joke is Mr. Beaver's, when Mrs. Beaver mentions bath night, Mr. Beaver says, worst night of the
year.
That's a great one.
Yes. They do give humor to Mr. Beaver. The first time he meets the children, Peter extends his hand, and then Mr. Beaver says, I'm not going to smell it if that's what you want.
Yeah.
So just, and get their brief, but they're smart insertions that just add a moment of a different kind of pleasure in the visual text.
Well, now let's go back to each of your experiences with film, or, you know, let's put it this way. Why would our listeners want to hear what you have to say versus what some well-known YouTuber might talk about?
I, like Charlie, have my degree in English, but I got interested in film studies even when I was in grad school. I started attending, just auditing film courses. And as a result, I have published over 40 essays on film in both national and international journals. I have presented around 20 papers at juried conferences. And then my fourth book is called Salvation from Cinema, : The Medium is the Message. And it is exhorting Christians, and actually Rutledge wanted me to move it beyond just Christians. I started the project for Christians, but to move it beyond to religious studies in general, so because they wanted to market it as a textbook in secular universities. So I'm talking about how many people, when they want to talk about religious implications of film, turn the medium into a content delivery system. And they just use film to extract messages. And I am arguing that we need to value the artistry of film itself. And so I'm challenging, I probably cite at least 50 different books where people, theologians, will write about film never having read a word of film theory, not knowing the technical language of film. And I consider it comparable to someone who says, I'm going to write a book on the atonement, but they never once mention the ransom theory and the difference between satisfaction theory. They don't even read the theology of atonement. So to write a book on film where you don't even read film theory seems irresponsible. So that is my passion.
Amen, and preaching. Yeah, I hate film that tries to say rather than show. I mean, just stop giving me celluloid sermons. All right, make a movie instead. Read C.S. Lewis's Experiment in Criticism and apply it to film. Please do us a favor.
Yes.
All right. So I'm going to continue then my experiences with film. I've taught film for decades. I taught a film and American culture course. I've taught it in courses on Christ and culture. I've worked in video production, spent several summers as an editor. I've written screenplays, edited more videos than I can remember. I've produced a dozen short films. Three of those films were accepted at film festivals, including Comic-Con San Diego for my Star Wars fan film, which I made with students. Two of our videos went viral. I wrote a monthly article for 10 years on film and culture and Christianity for a national church magazine called The Lookout. I have written for journals on a film, again, specifically related to Christian thought. I wrote a nice piece for Craig Detweiler once called Faith Without Film is Dull, in which I talk about C.S. Lewis's theory of film, if he'd had one, which is to say, I take Lewis's theories on imagination, myth, and art in general and apply them for film. I've written a chapter for a book on Narnia. The book was called Revisiting Narnia, and my chapter, which is the lead chapter of the book, was entitled The Silver Chair and the Silver Screen. And again, I take up Lewis's theory of myth and imagination and apply it to film for that. I also wrote a similar piece for the New York C.S. Lewis Society Bulletin, Signs and C.S. Lewis. So I've written a couple of chapters or essays that are specific to Lewis and film and connecting them together. And that's been rather fun. I used to have movie nights at my house, so I made kind of a mode of outreach, a sort of a small on-campus fun ministry with students. For 20 years, I had students come over to my house on Friday nights, 8 or 10 times a semester, and we'd watch a movie and talk about it. So I have a real passion for film. I've made movies. I've produced children who love film. My daughter's a professional photographer. My son's a professional videographer. And it's always been a big part of our lives. My entire family, my wife, my kids, and myself, we sit, we watch movies, we talk about them, and we love doing that over and over again.
I love the fact that you mentioned Lewis's Experiment in Criticism. That is something I actually quote in my Rutledge book when he says about Literary art is both logos, something said, and poema, something made.
Yes.
As logos, it tells a story. As poema, its aural beauties, and also by the balance and contrast and the unified multiplicity of its successive parts, it is an objective art, a thing shaped so as to give great satisfaction. And what I do, that was, of course, published in 1961. And then I compare that to something that was said by one of the preeminent film theorists of the next decade, Christian Metz, who says film is both rhetoric and poetics.
Nice.
So Lewis was anticipating. Of course, he didn't like cinema himself. I'm working on another book project. So my previous film book was called Salvation from Cinema. I am about two-thirds done with a book about Dorothy Sayre's interest in cinema. And she, unpublished letters show that she went to cinema a lot. She had a lot to say about it. But then I'm going to use her theory of art as written in Mind of the Maker and apply it to our analysis of film. But that book I'm calling The Wages of Cinema.
That's great.
I really value what you can do, Charlie. I could not make a film to save my life. I am a theory wonk. I am fascinated by theory. All my books are about the relationship between Christianity and theory, post-structuralism, neo-Marxist hegemony theory. So you have a skill that I really admire.
Well, one of the great ways to teach kids to read film is to make them make a movie. Mm-hmm. Once they've gone through that process and they realize how difficult it is, they can see film in all manner of new ways. They learn to focus on all the technique side of film, on what mise-en-scene actually is about, on lighting, setting, design, movement within the frame, off-camera space, off-frame space, those kinds of things. They pick them up because they've actually had to do that work. So I used to do that a lot in my film class, even though it wasn't a production class. I'd just say, y'all are going to make a movie. Mm-hmm. And the kids will put in hours and hours doing it and produce really quality work.
Well, now that leads perfectly to the next planned question, and that is, if you were directing a remake of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe tomorrow, first, would you rather make a movie or something like a 5-episode show of the book? Why and how would you do it? Sorry to say that I'm ending this first of a 2-part episode here. So to hear the answers to that question, you will need to listen to the final part, which should release no more than a week after this episode is posted. I will share a link in the show notes when it is available. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host, and you've been listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, which is a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I've also recently begun a short YouTube channel entitled 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to that. My guests today were Dr. Crystal Downing, co-director of the Mary Need Wade Center at Wheaton College, and Dr. Charlie Starr, who teaches at AB University in Philippi, West Virginia. Also in the show notes are some of the books they have published. Additionally, Charlie has been a guest several times, so there will be a link to at least some of his past appearances. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is All About Jack at podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it more easily. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.